likenow.com. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
Outsider's Corner on Art Focus. My name is Aurora Josephson.
Gregory Mackenzie Grennan was born in Detroit, Michigan on May 8, 1948. A true son of Motown, he loved the music and he loved the Detroit Tigers from the time he was a boy. He attended the Center for Creative Studies in Detroit, got a scholarship to attend Oxbow, but other than that remained an unschooled outsider. He began making art in the early 1970s in Detroit's Cass Corridor. Gregory then moved to Chicago, where he worked at Landfall Press, and his lifelong love for printmaking was nurtured and grew up. He then moved to Portland, Oregon in the mid-1970s, working at Glidden Paint Factory mixing colors, and was a member of Teamsters Local 206. He developed the technique of painting with oils on reverse of glass at this time. He used recycled, repurposed objects in his work, such as windows, doors, car windshields, and room screens. His first one-man show was given to him by Arlene Schnitzer at the Fountain Gallery of Art in 1982. Over the years, he was also represented in Portland by Jameson Thomas Gallery and Laura Russo Gallery, currently represented by Russo Lee Gallery. His work resides in the collection of the Portland Art Museum and in the collection of individuals such as Ichiro Suzuki, who bought a painting of a woman, one of the biggest honors of his career. Gregory painted about baseball. His sold-out 2003 show, Baseball is Second Only to Death, featured paintings of historical players and a miniature baseball diamond. Mostly, he painted women who he loved and respected above all else. Their faces would consume him. He once told me, "I can see a woman on the street and see her face for days in my head afterward." And these are the faces that you see in his paintings. He loved to ride Harley Davidsons and wished he could ride free. He was a lifetime Abate member, a brotherhood against totalitarian enactments. He loved his dog, Mr. Trouble, never adopting another after he left us. His favorite color was sap green. He is survived by his wife of 33 years, artist Mary Josephson, his daughter, performer Aurora Josephson, three sisters, a nephew, and two great nieces. A retrospective of his work will occur at the Schnitzer Museum on Neon in April of this year.
Gregory Grennan, my first guest on the Outsider's Corner of Art Focus, had little formal training and gained much of his experience and the tools with which to make his art from his work at Landfall Press in Chicago before moving to Portland, Oregon in the late 1970s. In addition to his strong work ethic, his work at Landfall Press would also teach him about mixing colors and the printmaking process. These techniques would in turn inform his paintings on reverse glass in the years to come, leading him to his own personal signature style of painting, which he taught himself. Over the 5 decades of his career as an artist in Portland, Gregory Grennan has shown his work at the Fountain Gallery, the Jameson Thomas Gallery. You may see more pictures of my visit with Gregory Grennan in his studio and some of his works in progress on my website, aurorajosephson.com. We are now at the Outsider's Corner
new segment on Art Focus. And I am here with Gregory Grenin, whom I have a number of questions for. What are some of the jobs that you had early on in life that you would say prepared you the most to be an artist?
My recollection of jobs would be any job working with my hands. I worked in factories, car factories. I worked in shipping and receiving places, like that sold office equipment. So I shipped office furniture all the way down to boxes of pencils. And from 8 o'clock till 5 o'clock. And I had a lot of different kind of jobs that I worked with my hands. And I think that's what got me interested and made me figure out that I was an artist. I wanted to do things with my hands. I didn't like jobs like sitting in an office or something, but I liked moving around and working.
So what early work would you say had the most impact on what you do now? I know that you've worked at a number of places, including Landfall Press.
Oh, right. My first classes in art were printmaking, lithography. And I worked in a lithographic plant that made posters for big street signs. And we'd print like 4 or 5 sheets that would be put together to make a large sign. And it was very interesting because it was an offset press and it made a lot of noise and you were standing up on top of it while it was working. And it was in the middle of the night. And but my experience with a really good lithographer got me the job at Landfall Press. And that was an education in itself, better than any graduate school you could go to. And ultimately, I realized I wanted to be a painter. I wanted to be a printmaker, but I wanted other people to print my work because it's hard work. And the thing it teaches you is problem solving. And you have to solve something right on the spot or you're in trouble. And that's one thing I have to say about that job. It was very unique that way. Very beautiful job. And you worked very hard. It was like being in the Marines. But 9-10 hours a day, six days a week.
Okay, so one job you wish you never had. Is there one that you...
There's one that I could have done without, and that was driving a yellow cab in Chicago.
Oh.
And I drove it from about 4:30 in the afternoon to morning rush hour around the clock when all the crazies are out. You never knew what you were going to find, and I don't know. I don't think you ever have a job where you just feel like you're being verbally abused all every day, you know, 10 hours a day. It's just really gets on you. And, you know, I bring myself home in my studio, open this big drawer of my shipping desk that I had there that I used for art, and I just throw all my tips in there and shove them clothes. I didn't want to touch them anymore, and then go take a shower and wash the night off me. But I just felt demeaned, you know? And I was glad that I quit that job finally.
All right, let's, how about, how do you think your parents saw you becoming as an artist? Becoming an artist. Do you think they thought of it as an act of rebellion against, because it's very different from the way that they live their lives. And did they become reconciled to the fact that you were an artist? Or was it an issue, really?
It was a big issue. As my two of my sisters took art courses from the age of 8. Oh. And I became an artist when I was 20. And my parents thought I was gold bricking, that I didn't want to work, didn't want to make money. And as my father would say, so you're doing your own thing now, huh? And does that pay the rent? You know, that kind of thing. And finally it took my sisters, who were artists themselves, to tell my parents something like, well, Greg is, you know, he's still in school, but he's winning awards and prize money in competitions with his prints, and he's selling his work, and nobody sells their work. And they tried, you know, even though they never said anything about it, but they tried, and my parents, you know, they just watched me. And I could never come even with them about the whole thing. And until I was in my 40s, my father finally said to me one day, and it just about made me cry. He said, so you're finally getting the hang of this art thing, huh? That's what you're gonna do, huh? And I'd been doing it for 25 years. And it was like, yeah, Dad, this is how I make my living. I bought my car with this money. I bought my motorcycle with this money. All money I made from making art, and my house. And I'm really proud of that, secretly proud of that. It's a big deal, Dad. And, you know, a couple of words here and there. I had to drop names to get their attention. You know, a friend of mine, David Kennerly, who is a photographer, famous photographer, actually, he gave me a present of a photograph of Nixon playing the piano. And my parents loved Nixon because they were staunch Republicans and I wasn't. And I gave them that picture and they just loved it. They put it up on their living room wall. They were so proud of it. And after they died, I got it back. And that's an amusing thing.
I bet it hasn't been appreciated so much since.
No. That's just, you know, a couple of stories. There's many.
Okay, my next, we'll move ahead a little in time. So what made you move to Portland from the Midwest? Was there a signal event or turning point for you where there was no turning back? So like, was there a point at which you were like, okay, this is it, I am out of here, I am moving to Portland?
It's interesting that you asked it that way, because I moved here in 1976. It was my year of personal revolution that I had with myself and those around me. I had trouble with girlfriends in Detroit and Chicago. I grew up in Detroit 25 years, and then I lived in Chicago for 3 years, and I moved here from Chicago. And then there was my family, and I wasn't getting along with them either. And I had some friends and some people in the art world that weren't treating me or giving me, you know, attention that I thought I deserved. So I came here on a vacation to Portland, and I fell in love just with the whole damn place. I remember getting up in the morning, walking around in parks and seeing grass and trees everywhere, way different than the tar and cement and smelly old ozone layer in Chicago. And then I remember it would rain softly in the afternoon and then stop at around 5. It doesn't do that anymore, but it was so wonderful. And I thought, well, it's either New York or Portland. And I said, I know a couple people in Portland. I don't know anybody in New York. And I don't want another big dirty city. So I moved here and I bought an old car for $50, fixed it up, and drove here with the smallest U-Haul trailer they had and left everything else of my life in Chicago.
Wow.
And I never looked back. And that's...
And you've accumulated all of this since that. It's like a second life almost.
Oh, yeah. And I even had a studio fire in 1980.
Oh, wow. And you lost
so
everything.
So I lost everything. And the funny thing is about it, the fire marshal who investigated the fire said, well, you know, you lost a lot of stuff and it's gonna hurt, but you're gonna find new stuff. And boy, was he right.
He was like, he predicted it.
He was right, you know, and some people decide never to have another item in their life. They have 10 things to their name, but I accumulate.
Not you. Well, wait, yeah, I'm going to post some lovely panorama photos of Gregory's studio on my website for your enjoyment. Okay, now moving ahead a few more years. Now you had the pleasure of showing at the Fountain Gallery, am I correct?
Well, that's correct.
Okay, so what did Arlene Schnitzer say to you the first time she offered you a show there? Do you remember her exact words?
I remember her exact words as yesterday. She said, never say never. The most well-dressed woman I'd ever met in my life, with high heels and jewelry and hair and the whole works. Very interested in the paintings I brought in, wanted to sell them all, and she got very nervous and wondered even more so when I said that, well, 16 of the 18 paintings had been sold already. I brought them in, I had to borrow them to show them to her. And she said, well, can I buy the other two? And she paid me for the full price for them and said, and you're making more, right? And I go, yes. And she says, I want to offer you a show in the main gallery in April with Jack Portland and Robert Colescott. And I didn't know who those people were, but I said, sure. And she sold every one of the paintings except one. And you know, while we were on the floor looking at my drawings and prints, she said, well, what about these? How much are these? Are you? And I said, oh, I'm not selling those. And she said, well, like I said, never say never. You're going to sell all of these. And she sold every one of them except one.
Wow.
I was just amazed. And she just had a beautiful sense of the art world and how to treat an artist and clients. And I miss her.
Rest in power, Arlene Schnitzer.
Yeah.
Okay. How about a slightly lighter note? So you mentioned recently that you would not be so inclined to put an ad in Art in America as you once would. I know you have before.
Oh, I loved it.
But okay, is there a magazine that you would put an ad in? Like, what are your favorite periodicals currently that are really inspiring you, or that you? As far as art goes, or fashion, or whatever.
You know something? I just, right now, I can't think of an art magazine that I especially like. I love doing ads and making sure that I have somebody to help me that knows this stuff, because I've had some really cool ads and posters that I made. I just didn't relate to the art world as it stands right now. Maybe I'll have to wait a little bit, but I don't think I would put an ad in a magazine right now. And I like reading about art and stuff, but I'd have to see. I'd have to be offered it. Somebody told me one time to never refuse an ad, or especially if it's in color or advertising, and that's a really good thing to know, because it really does help you show your work and see what other people think of it. If that answers your question.
Yes, thank you. How about any series that you're streaming, or any favorite, like a top five type thing?
Oh, well, I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
And yes.
Okay.
This is sort of an aside.
Cool.
And I shouldn't tell anybody this, but I wake up every day during the week at 5 o'clock and I watch Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford from 1957 and I love it. And you know who else loved it? John Belushi.
Really?
He even had him on Saturday Night Live. The show is only a half hour long and he does so much with that half hour. I'm just like freaked out. One time Clint Eastwood is on the show riding a Harley.
Wow.
And you see these older actors that have become famous that are on there. And it's very interesting. They have a lot of really neat old Fords and Chevys and Chryslers on the show. And I like looking at those because I like cars. And But that's not streaming. I just recently watched The Sopranos thing all the way through, day after day after day. And I'm going to watch the Many Saints of Newark, I think. It's tonight. They're showing a movie about a before The Sopranos, a prequel, if you may.
Right.
I like to watch Morse.
Oh, yeah.
A detective show on from England, and any British mystery, Mr. In Between. There's one called Unforgotten. I like that. Things in from Australia, Last Tango in Halifax, Vita. That's from south of the border, Shetland. And Wallander, which is north, Swedish and above. Those watched all the way through and couldn't get enough of. And it's very cold and they beat the crap out of the main character all the time. It's kind of interesting. And is that enough?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
So I skipped over this question. What makes painting on reverse glass your preferred mode of creation? And why not canvas or clay?
Oh.
Okay.
Well, I discovered painting on glass in 1973 when I was befuddled by the canvas. And I was just making mud out of them because I don't have patience and I have to paint the next color right away. And it was becoming mud on the canvas and just looking awful. Clay, you know, I've worked with clay, I've worked with etchings and carvings, and the thing is that I was trying to find a way to paint the picture that was in my head and that was making me feel emotional and upset with, in the same way of that the figure I was painting was, you know, acting. And the heads and faces I was interested at the time were women's heads, and I ran out of materials and started painting on glass windows because they were flat, and doors, panels that had glass in them, and they got muddy too until I turned them around and I realized there was the painting I was trying to do for a long time. It wasn't exactly like I wanted it, but it was better. And I couldn't get enough of them. I painted and painted and painted from 7 a.m. till 11 o'clock at night. And it was hot Detroit summer. And I think I only had coffee and cigarettes and a chocolate shake from Dairy Queen until my friends came and rescued me and took me to the bar and they wondered what the hell I was doing. And I took all that information with me when I moved to Chicago. And I just kept doing it. I painted on anything you could see through. Vinyl, plexiglass, glass, little clocks. I still do. Every time I see a window or a piece of glass or a door that has glass in it, I want to put a picture in it. And every time I paint, I learn something new about how to do it. I've shown with people from all over the world, like in New York, and they use glass as their medium, and everybody paints on glass differently. Not one person does it the same. And so it's interesting to talk with people about it. People have been doing it for centuries, but I discovered it by myself. And I don't know anybody that's painted for 50 years on glass. I've been painting on glass since 73. I've been a painter for longer. But yeah, I don't know. If I may throw a couple of more little pieces of inspiration towards you when I was talking about Landfall Press.
Yes.
I just want you to know that I worked with some incredible artists, and I'm just going to give you a few who inspired me. Ed Paschke, Claus Oldenburg, Chuck Close, Philip Perlstein, Pat Steer, one of my favorites, Robert Cottingham, and Alfred Leslie, the most famous artist that nobody knows from Massachusetts. And I have stories about every one of them. We weren't supposed to talk to the artists when we were there, and they thought we were pissed off and didn't like them until the boss left the room and they said, "Why don't you guys ever talk to us?" We go, "We're not allowed to talk to you." So, but they all talked to us, and I'll never forget them. And I just maybe want to be an artist, a painter, in my own right, more and more and more. So I wanted to throw that in.
Oh, thank you. Sounds like they inspired you.
Oh, they did, Mary.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they did.
Okay, so my last question for you, what is one place anywhere in the world where you would like to show your work and have not yet?
Oh, yeah.
You've shown far and wide, but...
Well, when I lived in Detroit, I was sort of in the cast corridor, knew all those artists. We never talked about art, we just made them. So my show was like my studio, my destruction. I was in a couple of group shows. It would be nice to have a one-person show in Detroit to remember my friends from the early 70s. If I want to get real about it, I've been thinking about traveling to Europe, maybe Italy and France. It would be nice to have a show in Italy. It'd be nice to have a show in France. And I don't know how I would do it. I think I'd have to do it the same way I got one here, is just to make a painting and walk in a gallery with it and see if they liked it. And that's what I have to say about that, because you never know.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me into the studio. It's an honor to be here, and I really enjoyed the interview. Thank you.
Thank you, Aurora.
All right.
I'll tell you one thing. It was easier than I thought.
All right, yay.
You did a good job.
Thank you.
And,
you are listening to KBOO. This is Art Focus, and you have been listening to the new segment, The Outsider's Corner. My name is Aurora Josephson. My guest today was Gregory Grennan. And I wish to thank Ava Lake, Joseph Gallivan, Ray Bodwell, and the other staff at KBOO, which helped make this segment a reality. Thank you. We also ask you, art lovers out there, why not subscribe to KBOO on our website? We hope you enjoyed the program.
Andy Warhol loves to scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
WOOO Portland por el 90.7 FM y transmitiendo en línea a través de KB.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 22 de febrero del 2022. Hong Kong requerirá que sus más de 7 millones de residentes se sometan a pruebas del coronavirus en marzo, dijo hoy martes Carrie Lam, directora ejecutiva de Hong Kong, mientras el territorio lucha por contener su peor brote del coronavirus. Los residentes deberán realizar 3 pruebas en un periodo corto a partir de marzo y Hong Kong ampliará su capacidad de prueba a 1 millón de pruebas por día desde unas 200 mil por día para el próximo mes.